privileged to be joined today by a man who laced up not only a pair of skates in the Elite Ice Hockey League, but a well-beloved red tie. And by the time he left these shores, he had picked up EIHL Coach of the Year twice, taken the helm of the GB national side, but most importantly, he had led your Belfast Giants to the promised land with a dramatic league title win in 2011-12. A man whose presence is still very much felt today in the SSC arena. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Doug Christensen. Coach, welcome back to View from the Bridge. First of all, before we even start, I hear congratulations are in order.
They are. My wife and I, we had our first baby, Maeve. She joined us a week ago. On March 31st, and we're over the moon. My wife and I, we met in Belfast, two Americans met in a meeting in Belfast, and got married there. And so her name's obviously a nod to the island where we met and all the great people and great memories that we had there. So it's a place that's near and dear to us and will be for the rest of our lives, obviously, with Maeve, and we're thrilled.
Beautiful name, and obviously our gratitude to you for giving up your time with a wee bae in the house just over a week old. And if I can be so bold as to speak for the whole organization and fan base, we all obviously send our congratulations and best of health to you guys, especially with everything that's kind of going on at the minute. But listen, where do we find you in the world at the moment? Where are you right now? We'll obviously get into where you were before kind of the world hit pause, but where do we find you tonight?
We're still in Indianapolis. We bought a house here. We'd lived in Chicago primarily since we returned from the UK, other than when we were in Milwaukee. And so we moved here with the fuel. We're excited. We enjoy the community. It's very similar to Milwaukee in terms of size of a city and things to do. And so it's like home for me, and it's a nice opportunity for Megan to a great spot to help start raise a family and build her career as well.
And obviously we want to get into your time in Belfast, but first of all, let's talk about that. Obviously the world has kind of turned on its head very recently, but talk to me about life as the head coach and GM of a fairly young franchise in the ECHL, the Indy Fuel. How was it going up until kind of everything got strange?
It was great. Indianapolis is a great city. I mean, it's got 1.6 million people. So in terms of resources and opportunities for players to do things, there's plenty to do. And we have fantastic ownership with Jim Hallett, who reminds me a lot of Jim Gillespie and their overall approach. No, it's absolutely the truth. They're very, very similar. I mean, I remember very vividly Jim Gillespie sitting down and meeting with me at the Costa in the Odyssey Arena when I first got the job. And he told me about why he bought the Belfast Giants, dating back to the Troubles, and how he always wanted to help Belfast when he came back. And he gave me a fantastic couple personal stories. And as we're walking out of the Costa, about to go our separate ways, he said, "And I expect to win the league title." Jim is very much – Jim Hallett, the owner here, is very much the same way. Very, very committed to the community, very, very committed to – the organization as a whole, but desperate to win, is wants to give us every resource to win, no different than Jim Gillespie. And so the two men are very similar, successful businessmen who love their sports and love their community and hold a high standard. So from that personal experience, it's very similar in that regard, and we had a great year. We had pretty much a complete rebuild. We only had one player finished the season who was on the team the year before. And so we really retooled, and it took us a while to get going. But once we got to Thanksgiving, and from Thanksgiving on, we were more or less a first place team, and we were peaking at the right time. But we were running a 100-yard race inside an 80-yard gym, and the season just stopped abruptly. And that was the end of our season, and obviously the end of the world probably as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, those shockwaves are being felt throughout global sport. And obviously, you know, it's that caveat of there are things right now that are much more important than sport. But still, you know, you're a hockey guy, and I know how much kind of love and attention you pour into this season. So it must hurt to see the guys work so hard and for that just to come to such an abrupt halt.
It does. And, you know, for players in the ECHL, not that dissimilar to the Elite League.
Yeah.
They make decent money, but they're not getting rich. And the one thing that's really happening right now, and I'm sure it's not that dissimilar in the UK and Ireland is the fact that you've got so many people who are going to be out of work. And so these players are leaving their jobs where if they wanted to work in the past, they'd go into a different a private sector, get a job. Nobody's really hiring. And so it's tough living for these guys. It's a tough situation. And for all of the players, whether it's players from Europe, players from North America, it's a new reality when the season ends. Everybody's kind of used to your season's going to end abruptly, whether it's a playoff game or, you know, the end of the regular season. But you really aren't prepared for this, and that makes it really tough. And so there are some really good things that people are doing in terms of spinning chiclets, and the Players Association try to raise funds for the players, especially those who can use some additional money.
Yeah, I've seen our own Jordan Smotherman as well auctioning off kind of game worns for the cause for the ECHL and that kind of thing. It's lovely to see that kind of maybe a worn out cliche of hockey family, hockey community, but it really does rally in a time of need. And, you know, I guess we're all staring into the unknown together, and we can only hope that things will return to some kind of normal after this. But I guess it's more fun right now to look back than look forward, Doug. So if you don't mind, you know, prior to, sure. To your return to coaching and obviously that impressive playoff run you had in the ECHL with Manchester, you spent 4 years in the United States Hockey League as their director of player development and recruitment. Did my research today and saw that you set a league record in that time for draft picks, NHL draft picks in 2017, 40 draft picks out of the USHL. You know, with that success, with it all going, you know, what seems to be so well there, was it always the plan to get back into coaching? What motivated you to move on from the United States Hockey League?
I really enjoyed my job with the USHL. The USHL, for the people who don't know in the UK, basically what it would be like is if you had a league between the players of the ages of 16 and 20 and the best players in the country. All go to different cities, and it's almost like a mini pro hockey, and the best players are playing against each other. And that obviously draws talent from all over the world, in the United States, obviously all over Canada, all over the world. And within the country, you only had 17 teams at the time when I was there, 16 now. And the hockey was really good. And we had a clear-cut mission. We wanted to be the best development league in the world. And, you know, Canada's done an outstanding job with the OHL, the Western League, and the Quebec League at developing pro players for a long time. But we felt very strongly that while we were with the USHL, that if we could grow the brand and educate people on the opportunities to not just play college hockey and to excel at college hockey, but to be an NHL superstar, that you could come to the USHL, you never had to leave your country, and be able to have a tremendous amount of success. And we were able to do that, and I love that. But the one thing is, I didn't leave coaching because I wanted to leave coaching. I left coaching, in the summer after Sheffield and GB and took the job in the USHL because, when I was with Sheffield, my father had passed, my mother had cancer. Yep. And so I decided that there was things that were more important. And so I put coaching on the shelf because the USHL was going to allow me to live in Milwaukee, which is where my mother is from. And, it was from that moment that I had some of the most purposeful time of my life, and the USHL was really, really accommodating to my needs. And so for me, I didn't know if I was going to have the opportunity to get back into coaching because it's hyper competitive. And after 4 years out, I didn't know how that would play out. But it did. It came together really nicely, and I enjoyed my time in Manchester. We had a great team. We wound up losing to the defending champion, in Newfoundland, who's the affiliate of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and in a great series. And, you know, we wound up, unfortunately, the team, because of the business reasons, wind up closing doors. And I was fortunate to land on my feet and get to come to Indy. So a lot of things happened in a short amount of time. I was great to get back into coaching. Mm-hmm. But there are moments there where you wonder if that opportunity is going to come.
Yeah, I mean, with that time in the USHL, you know, it's beautiful context, you know, obviously talking about your family there and how it sort of served its purpose and got you through that time. But did it also feel a little bit like coming full circle with the United States Hockey League? You obviously began your career in Green Bay with the Gamblers way back in 1996. do you think that having been having been in the skates of those players, you know, did that help you in the job? You know, you were there yourself.
Absolutely, 100%. It was full circle, and in a lot of ways, those years are some of the really, really influential days of my life. And we won a championship when I was in Green Bay. It was my first championship, and I remember leaving or skating out of the ice in Green Bay and being 18 years old. And there's 4,000 fans in the rink, and you're just, wow, what are all these people doing on a Friday and Saturday night? But it was such a cool experience, and it really prepared you for higher levels, and it prepared you. It was a nice break academically between high school and college, and the fact that you did grow up a little bit. You weren't 18 years old and wide-eyed on a campus. You were a couple of years older, and you were able to, recognize what was important and what wasn't. And so for me, I loved it, and I thought that, and I really think more so than anything, that hockey is expensive. There's not a clear cut path to make it to the NHL the way that if you're in the NBA or the NFL, if you're in the NBA, you go to college for 1 year or you go for a few years and then you turn pro. If you're in the NFL, you go to college, then you go to pro. Hockey, there's so many different paths. And I thought that if we could clarify that mission, it was going to help families. It was going to help American families, and it would help people from all over the world to be able to have success. I mean, you look at some of the players who did come over and play junior hockey in the United States, although not in the USHL, and youth hockey, Mark Garside, Robert Dowd, and obviously now Corey Nielsen's boys, that they've been able to have success, and that opens up doors for them, whether they go back and play in the Elite League or they play somewhere else, to pursue academics while playing hockey at a high level.
Massive cog in the machine, especially in this part of the world. And it's something that I hope to continue to see. I'm going to throw the brakes on here. There's a side note, because you've mentioned Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you've mentioned Green Bay. And I know that your roots are in Milwaukee and that I think you're a Packers guy. I need to ask you.
Who isn't? They disown you in Wisconsin if you're not a Packers fan. You have to walk to Illinois.
I'll allow you. The Brew Crew as a proud Red Sox fan, they're my other team. But
I love the Red Sox. There's very few things like Fenway. But what's that right. like about a team named after making beer? Let's be honest. I spent 7 years in the Elite League. I think if there's one thing that I know the commonalities between all of the fan bases, that the Milwaukee Brewers should be a lot of their favorite teams.
Amen to that, brother. Look, as a fellow Packers fan, a long-time Packers fan, I just need to ask as a segue and a side note, do you think that Aaron Rodgers has another Super Bowl in him under Matt LaFleur?
You know what? This year, I worry was their best chance. I think they'll get back to an NFC Championship game again, and then it's one of those situations where you just got to win a game. So I will say yes, because I'm very confident they'll get back to an NFC Championship game. I'm worried that they only got one more kick at it. And after that, they got to move on, because it's so hard to get to that spot. And you need so many breaks. You need health. I mean, if you look at it, Aaron Rodgers has missed significant parts of two seasons. If he's healthy, you always have a chance. But they got to make sure they're going for it now. They can't be waiting 4 or 5 years because it'll be over by then.
I thought last season was going to be it, but c'est la vie. I'll get in trouble for not talking hockey on a hockey podcast, so we'll get back to it. But thanks for that, for indulging me. I want to take you back to 2010. You had spent 3 years in Edinburgh, and I think it's fair to say you kind of gained cult status in that city as a player, then a player coach, and then a head coach before the Belfast Giants came calling. Tell me a bit, first of all, about your time in Edinburgh in the old barn. And then how the move came about and how it felt to make that move across the Irish Sea.
I loved Edinburgh. It's a world-class city. I mean, I've said a lot of times in a lot of different conversations that one of the distinct privileges of my life was living there. For me, at 28 years old, to get the operations of a professional hockey team and be able to learn the lessons on the job was extremely important and invaluable. And those are things that I tap into today. Scott Neal and I, just messaging on Facebook in the last 2 weeks. I owe a lot to Scott in terms of giving me the opportunity. We really enjoy it. It was a grind. It was tough. There weren't easy days. But if you think about it, I look back at when we signed Sean Perkins and we really didn't have the budget to go out and sign him. And I said, okay, Scott, do you mind if I ask the fans? And he was like, and I think he probably said something to the effect of, yeah, go ahead, like not thinking anything would happen. And within a couple of days, we had enough money for his flight, his ITC, his salary for the rest of the year. You know, these are fans who are already shelling out money to come to games. And now they're dipping into their own pockets because they thought that we had a team that could be really good, and we did. And so it was that kind of committed fan base and the humble roots that we had there. But we really were building something, and it was a lot of fun. And that last team that we had there, we could go toe-to-toe with anybody. And that was a great experience. I mean, we had Garside, we had Ben O'Connor, we had great goaltending and Cody Rudkowski. But if you look at the players that came through when we were there, we had some really high-end guys. And like Mark Hurtubise obviously led the Elite League in scoring, but he went on to play for another 10-plus years afterwards. And so it was a great experience. It was a really good learning experience for myself. You know, we had such good people, whether it was Jock Hay, John Fairley. I mean, so many people just around the building, Mr. B, who were just willing to help in so many different ways. And that made it a special experience for me, and it was a lot of fun.
You know, I've said it once, I've said it a million times. Show me a more dedicated, loyal, hardcore fan base in hockey in this part of the world than the Edinburgh Capitals, and I hope to see them back one day. But obviously then, Belfast came calling, you know, Mr. Jim Gillespie lifted the phone to you. How did the move come about then, and how did it feel to make that jump into suddenly a 7,000 cap arena?
I mean, it was surreal. I was down at the playoff weekend, and you know, I was just walking around and I saw Todd Kelman. We were just having a small chat, and he just said, I might give you a call next week, I just want to pick your brain about something. And I didn't think anything of it at the time, and I said okay, and he wound up calling me, and this was when Steve Thornton had decided to go home, and they obviously had just won the championship. You know, I was there the playoff championship, and obviously had a good team. Yep. And I wound up getting the call from Todd, and he said, we'd like you to come over and interview. And I obviously was over the moon, and went over, had a great meeting in the Cathedral Quarter with Todd. And he's like, we'll be back in touch. And I went home. I went on the ferry the next day. I wasn't really sure if I was going to get the job, but I had a good feeling that might come to fruition, and Todd called me and he asked if I wanted the job, and I did, but at the time I was still negotiating with Scott, and Scott and I were going back and forth on it for coming back. And you know, it was one of those situations where, as much as I loved Edinburgh and as much as I loved the organization, you know, it was a great opportunity. And you know, to then be able to 6 months later be coaching against the Boston Bruins in Belfast was surreal. And
weird.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, you go from, you know, coaching the Edinburgh Capitals. If you recall, I'd had knee surgery because I shattered my knee. Yep. The first period of the first game of the season, never played again.
That's right.
And so to be able to transition to Belfast, I thought was a fantastic experience for me. And it was really, it was special because you learned the passion was fantastic. The purpose of the organization was second to none. And the potential, you could just see it. You just knew that there were some really good days ahead. And even though there'd always been good days behind, but in terms of Scott's vision for not just taking it to be the best organization in the Elite League, but to make it one of the best pro organizations in hockey, it was something you could get behind. It was something that the players bought into. And, you know, there was a self-fulfilling prophecy that happened every year in recruiting, because one player would help recruit the next player, which would help you open the door to another guy, and over and over and over. And that's really a testament all the way back to its beginning roots, you know, with Paxton Schulte and, you know, obviously Todd and Shane Johnson and Thorts. All the way through to where they are today with Kiefer, that it's continued to grow.
You know, I guess you were in pretty early then for kind of 10-11 preseason. How much of that team did you have a hand in putting together? Obviously, guys like Mark Garside and Dan Welch had made the move from Edinburgh along with you. Was that squad part assembled when you were signed, or how much of kind of Christensen DNA was in that first team?
All of the imports, with the exception of guys who were on a school package and weren't doing 2 years. So, like, Tim Cook, he was there doing his school program. But almost all of the imports were guys that we brought over. And, you know, obviously you had Graham Walton, who was there. But for the most part, all of the players were new. And it was a little bit different because the Elite League does force you to choose, are you going to try to rebuild and bring in new guys every year, which I didn't mind doing, or are you going to try to retool and reload? And we tried to bring a good number of players from Edinburgh that I thought could be good, but at the same time make sure that our balance was not just all these guys from Edinburgh, because there's going to be a totally different standard that we were going to be held to.
And in that first season, you know, you did have a hell of a team. You missed out on the league title by a single agonizing point to the Sheffield Steelers, who themselves pipped the Cardiff Devils at the post with the same total number of points. I know how much it hurt me in the stands that year, but how much of a stinger was it to come so close that year and miss out? And do you think it was a primary motivator for what was to follow?
It's a good question.
take your time.
I remember Christmas, we lost 3 games in a row.
Yeah,
and one of which was, and hopefully you don't remember this, was against Newcastle.
Unfortunately, I do.
and I think they had
very, you know, few
seven
players
and a bus driver playing that night.
Yeah.
And I just remember being absolutely devastated in my apartment in the Titanic Quarter on New Year's Eve, and they're, you know, shooting off all the fireworks and everything like that, and just beside myself, because I thought that we were in a lot of trouble to win the league. But the second half of that season I thought was really special. We had a lot of really good games, and it really came down to a one-off game against Sheffield. And we were in Ice Sheffield, and, you know, we wound up losing the game. It was a great hockey game, and we wind up losing the game. And I knew at that game that the winner of that game was going to have inside track and was going to win it. And we didn't. We lost the Challenge Cup as well. And so it was a heartbreaking year from that point of view. But I think what it did make us all appreciate was you can be really, really good, and it's not going to be good enough, and you have to be excellent. And the following year, we weren't really good. We were excellent. And, I mean, I don't know how many teams are going to – I don't know if there'll ever be a team that'll break that record in terms of number of losses, losses on the road. I mean, all those things. I don't know if those records will be beaten, but that team was special, and it was a lot of fun to be a part of.
I'm afraid I'm not going to let you escape it. Before we talk about that kind of infamous 2011-12 season, you were part of the viral Belfast Giants Christmas video, which saw the team and staff miming and dancing through the arena along to Mariah Carey's classic "All I Want for Christmas Is You." It also featured the frankly gigantic Mike Hoffman cutting a rug in an elf suit. Doug, look, it's been 10 years. The dust has settled. You can tell me honestly. What was your first reaction to that idea?
I liked it. I
did
liked
you
it.
Really?
I did. You know, and Todd said, you know, he said, I've waited my whole life for a coach who will do this. I've always wanted to do this. And, you know, there are a few things that are funny about it. Number one, we were in first place at the time, so it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And two, I always think that guys enjoying themselves and having fun is a key point to hockey. Making guys want to come to the rink every day. And I thought that was a lot of fun. And so they had this idea, and the best part of the whole story was Todd and I were in the locker room, and Deb is we're getting the whole thing ready to start off, and Hoff comes in. He's coming from class. He's like, oh, this will be great. He's like, I should get my elf suit. And Todd and I shared a look that you cannot imagine. And Todd just goes, what? You have an elf suit? He's like, yeah, I have an elf suit. And he goes, go, get out of here right now. Go get your elf suit and come back. So that wasn't a suit we had for him. That wasn't anything. That was just Mike Hoffman owned an elf suit.
Oh my God.
And, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
It's not only the fact that Mike Hoffman owned an elf suit, but he actually brought it across the Atlantic with him. You know, it's like that. This is going to come
actually bought it at the cost. He bought it at the costume store in Belfast. He's
oh my God.
And we're like, what? Why did you do that? And he's like, well, you never know when you're going to need it.
And hey, look, wasn't he right?
He was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. A million hits or whatever later,
and it
he was
year
correct.
By year. Well, look, that 2011, 2012 side, as you referenced there, that has gone down in history, I would say, amongst the most beloved Giants rosters ever assembled. You know, that team, from a fan's perspective, it just never knew when it was beaten. You had young sort of British upstarts like Craig Peacock and Rob Dow just dueling it out, trying to one-up each other. The genesis of the Bash Brothers line, Darryl Lloyd, Adam Keefe, and poor Mark Garside in the middle of them. The experience and the maturity of a captain like Jeremy Rebick. You had shut down defense like Nick Kuiper, John Pelly, points machine. I could go on, but who for you were the standout characters of that team, both on and off the ice?
Well, it was a fun team, obviously. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Kuipes is hilarious. I still have a video of him on my phone that he can do an auction voice like you've never seen in your life.
He actually did a jersey auction one night. Stood up on the merch table and called the full auction. It was one of the best nights of my life.
he was outstanding. And then you look at the group as a whole had a lot of different personalities. But obviously Jeff Mason had an outstanding season. You look at the different guys that stepped up, but the one thing that I think people remember is you had Garce, Keith, and Lloyd. And if you are a Belfast Giants fan, you can close your eyes and visualize what that looked like. And there's very few teams, very few groups that I've ever been a part of, but it just has a group that has a line that has that identity. And every single night, the opposing teams had to worry about them. And they had just enough offense that they could score. And so that made them dangerous. And they had just enough absolute craziness that they were really effective. And Kiefer and Lloyd, Mark Garside had a first front row seat to the best show in town. Because those guys, they worked their tails off. But they also, especially Kiefer. Kiefer knew when the game was on the line and when not to cross the line. Lloyd, not so much, but they were really, really effective. And that allowed us to be able to have our third line play against other teams' first line. Yeah. And that always created a matchup where we had the ability to have a guy be either a first line or second line against opposing teams' thirds. And that was the real difference maker for us in the season. Jeremy Rebick was an outstanding captain. And John Pelly, although he had this unbelievable offensive season in Cardiff, he was kind of snake bit. And what he and I talked about down the stretch was just, we need you for that one big goal. We need you. That's what we hired you is for the one big goal. And he winds up getting the one big goal in the home game against Sheffield. And so, it was a special group. It was a special bunch of characters. And thank God social media wasn't as prevalent as it is now, because I think the guys had a lot of fun with that championship.
you mentioned the names there, but I said at the top of this interview that your presence is still very much felt here. How does it feel for you kind of a decade later to see Mark Garside reach a testimonial year in Belfast and to see Adam Keefe raise titles from captain to coach, knowing that you had your hand in bringing them to Belfast? Do you get a sense of satisfaction in seeing those careers continue to flourish here?
I do. And Jeff Mason, to add to that too.
Of course. Yes.
One of the things, and I never really thought about this, and I never thought about it at the time, but it's interesting when you take jobs and when you go places, how it will impact your life. And a lot of times you can foresee how it will shake out, but a lot of times you don't. I don't think Adam Keith or Jeff Mason, when they got on the plane for the first time to play for the Belfast Giants, thought that they would wind up getting married and start families, in Jeff Mason's case. In Belfast.
Yeah.
I didn't think when I got on the ferry that I was going to wind up meeting my wife. And I didn't think that when we moved to Indiana that we'd be having our daughter here. And it's a testament to the city. It's a testament to how the organization is run. It's a testament to the people involved that all these guys, and you can take it to Steve Thornton, you can take it to Shane Johnson. I mean, there's a lot of players that have just come to Belfast and stayed.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a woman, but a lot of times that's because they really appreciate the city. They appreciate the Giants as a whole, and a lot of them are still involved. And so I think for all of us, it's a lot of fun. And it's fun for me. Kiefer and I talk all the time or text all the time. And he's a heck of a hockey coach, and I think it's going to be pretty – it is pretty exciting to see him continue to do so well.
Talking about him as a coach, I actually had sort of thought today just about some of kind of my standout memories from your time there. There's a few. I think I've got maybe three main ones, and I don't know that I can share them all. One of them was in Lanchet. We can maybe leave that one off. But I've told this story many times before. We were on a boat back from, God, probably Dundee. I think it was like a Sunday road game to Dundee, and they ran one of those coaches. So the fans and the team were all on the same kind of graveyard shift boat back to Belfast. I was on my way outside for a breath of Marlborough fresh air, and I looked into the little room to the right-hand side of like the door that leads outside, and you were there sitting with the shirt on still. This was like maybe 1-2 in the morning, laptop open, and you were cutting game tape, and I was like, it's Sunday night. There's no way that anyone's practicing tomorrow. That always stuck with me. You know, I think you as a coach are remembered for that kind of attention to detail, attention to tactics, to systems, that kind of tireless work ethic. I don't know if you'll agree or disagree, but you know, what drives that work ethic that you have? Is it a love for the game? Is it, you know, family? Is it pressure? Is it pride in what you do? What's the engine kind of that keeps you going?
Jeez, maybe I was just sitting there watching a movie. No, I mean, I didn't have that capability. I didn't have Netflix. to be honest, I love what I do. It's a hyper competitive environment, and every single week, you know whether you are good or bad. And it's something that it's hard to explain. And both of my parents, they worked their tails off. And there was always a standard. You weren't going to be perfect, but there was always a standard. And you knew what that standard was for how you present yourself, how you communicate, how you work. And I always felt as though, you know, for me, the families who come to Belfast Giants games, the players who leave their families to move across an ocean, to the people who are involved in my life, I have to do a good job. And if I don't do a good job, it impacts someone's night out. It impacts, you know, you spend, you're talking about the graveyard shift. So you probably woke up and went to work the next day. And if we didn't do our job, that really sets your whole week off on the wrong note. If you spend your vacation going to Germany, it sets your week off. And so for me, there's a competitiveness, there's a pride to it, but I started it with what it really is, which is I just love what I do. And if you are fortunate enough to be a job to love what you do, you sure as hell better work at it, because if you don't, you'll find someone else who will, and you'll find a job that's doing something you don't love, and there's nothing worse than that.
And, you know, I mean, tremendous answer, and that season, that work. That, of course, that 11-12 year ended with a winner-takes-all doubleheader in Belfast against defending champions, the Sheffield Steelers. Belfast got the win that they needed in Game 1, and that game itself is a night that many, including myself, call the greatest game, Giants game, they've ever witnessed. Take me through what you remember from that day. You know, how did that play out for you on the bench, and how did it feel when that final buzzer finally went?
Total relief when we won.
Yeah.
In a relief that I'd never felt before and probably haven't felt since. it is a league campaign, and although the playoffs here are different, but a league campaign is hard because it's every single day, every single goal, they all add up to a same spot. And you can never afford to take a night off against a Dundee or Fife, because those are the games you had to win. Otherwise, you had to go into Nottingham or into Sheffield and to win a game just to make up for the fact that you lost a game that you shouldn't. And I think that was a big lesson that we took out of year one, because we also lost to Edinburgh in year one as well on the road. And so I think for me, the first feeling was relief. The second feeling was just absolute elation. Seeing Jim on the ice with the guys, seeing the guys celebrate, because they put so much work into it and they cared. And it was a fun group to be around. And, you know, they're a committed group. They bought in, they're committed. And, you know, the one thing that I really liked about that weekend was you walked into the rink on Friday night with a knot in your stomach that should be holding a cruise ship to a moor. It was hard to explain, because you sat there and you said, what if tonight doesn't go well? The whole momentum of 7 month swings to Sheffield, and now all of a sudden you've got this angst. And I thought the guys came out, and they came out like their hair was on fire.
Shit.
And, they hit everything that moved. They moved their feet. They moved the puck. And I just remember, but then really going back and watching the videos of different people on YouTube, or different people that, would talk about it, those last couple minutes and the fans singing and chanting. And that's something I'll never forget.
Yeah, the standout iconic moment from that game was Adam Keefe's double shot block down in the west end of the arena. Did you know that that had happened at the time? Did you see it?
No, I didn't. but I heard about it. But you know what? I hate to say it, but that was indicative of how he played. That was that was a regular thing. Kiefer absolutely putting his body on the line for the team, and guys absolutely respected that and rose their games because of it. And he garnered so much respect from the group, because everybody on the team knew that Adam Keefe was going to do anything it took to win.
I was kind of one more thing I want to talk about. Your final year in Belfast was the 2012-2013 season, which, ultimately will be remembered as a turbulent one for the organization. There was a new owner who, in my own opinion, doesn't deserve the airtime here. But that threw the organization into disarray, with the club ultimately, coming out the other side with the kind of newfound security of the Odyssey Trust. What I do want to talk about, though, is the Continental Cup in Landshut. But before I move on to that, you're bound to have been incredibly proud of your players through a very difficult kind of experience there. Obviously, playing without that uncertainty, playing without pay, just kind of getting on with the job for the team, not knowing where that was going. It must have been proud for you to see the guys kind of weather that storm.
Yeah, I've been involved with a lot of crazy situations. In hockey, I don't think that there was a moment that I was more proud of a group, that going through that, standing up to that. But that moment doesn't go without repercussions and long lasting changes. And we kind of talked about it off the air, but there's a very real chance that Todd Kellman and I would still be there had that not been the case. I know Todd's still there, and obviously he started a fantastic venture in Cardiff. But we really enjoyed working together. We really loved Belfast, and we really believed that we were building something. And I think it was a situation where when all that went through, it was kind of like dog years. Every single day was, it took a toll on us mentally and physically and emotionally. And I agree with you. It's not worth really going into the person, but I think it should be. It's a hard piece for people to recognize that it wasn't really that we didn't want to come back or stay. It was much more to do with the fact that the world had changed and things had been taken out from what we were thought they were going to be. And it's great that the organization is where it is today. But that was a seminal moment for a lot of us as individuals. But for the team as a whole to stick with it, I thought was fantastic. And, you know, it was the first year of the conference system, and nobody really knew, is it a big deal, is it a little deal? But I remember us as a team going into Sheffield and very vividly saying, you know, this is a nice chance for us to win a conference championship. And it was a big deal because at the time you looked at our conference, those are all heavy hitters. Yeah. That was a hard conference to win with Nottingham and Sheffield. And obviously ourselves and Cardiff and Coventry, that was hard. And so our guys took great pride in that. And that was probably as hard, if not harder, to win than any other trophy, because that's tough against all the big boys.
You know, speaking of trophies that are hard to win, obviously that year was the Giants' foray into Europe, into the Continental Cup in Lancia in Germany. In 2012, how did it feel to lead Belfast into Europe? You'd obviously played in Italy as a player before, but your first kind of, I think I'm right in saying your first trip into Europe as a coach. Did that feel good to kind of lead the team into Europe and then see obviously such a large travel and support at the rink when you arrived in Lancia?
I mean, the fans in the stands and then the beer garden, I mean, I thought it was second to none. I mean, it was a playoff weekend passion, playoff weekend attendance, in Germany. And, to see that, and, you know, obviously, in my opinion, we probably are a better team. And if we played in the best of seven, than Landshut, but they won the one game and obviously they moved on, but it was a great experience. It was fun for the guys to see hockey from different places. And I thought it was a special experience for everybody involved. And, you know, obviously now the Elite League is much more tied to Europe. And I think it's those beginning forays and the success that Nottingham's had that has really, and other clubs that have had, that has allowed hockey in the UK to grow and to get the respect on the international level, which then the national team has really taken even further.
Yeah. I honestly could sit and talk all night, Doug, but I'm conscious you've got a brand new baby in the house and a wife who's probably wondering where you are. To wrap this one up, you know, I really, really appreciate the time and I've really enjoyed the opportunity to chat to you. Obviously that your time in Belfast has been one chapter of many in your career to this point. But it's hard for me, kind of as a fan of the club, and I was a fan back then too, and I was there week in, week out. It's hard to ignore your kind of outspoken fondness for Belfast and the club. In the grand scheme of things, how do you look back on your time here, if you were to sum it up?
I met my wife here, there. I truly enjoyed the mission of the Belfast Giants. And it was something that was meaningful to me as a European history major, as somebody who just had a better, and again, I'll never fully understand, but just that there was a meaning to the team and to see the community and to be involved in the community, I thought was absolutely fantastic. And so for me, I've always said this, that the Belfast is a special place. It's special because it is different. It is unique. And sometimes it's the things that weren't the best that really pull together the communal feel and the communal passion that somebody from the outside can see. And I was able to see that and I was able to enjoy it. And I was able to enjoy it in droves because I got to speak to so many different people in so many different parts of the city. And to share their passion for whether it was hockey or whatever else it was. And it was at a moment in my life where all I was really worried about was winning hockey games, enjoying my life experience, having the opportunity to learn myself and to really embrace what all of Belfast was. We obviously got married there and named our daughter in a way that I think is a nod to that time that we had there. It was special. It was great. I wouldn't change it. Other than probably the one thing that we talked about with the ownership change and how that really impacted it and changed things for the negative. But I don't know if everything happens for a reason, but I do look back at those 3 years in Belfast as some of the best times of my life.
Look, Doug, it's been a pleasure and a joy to catch up with you again tonight. Please keep in touch and health to the new baby. Congratulations again. And I've no
Thanks
doubt
so much.
We'll talk somewhere else down the line. Thank you.
Please, everybody, stay safe. Wash your hands 6 feet away. All those things that people are supposed to be doing. hopefully everybody gets through this. And hockey in the fall, I think everybody will have a renewed passion for getting out, having a pint, having a good night, and seeing some great hockey.
Amen to that. Thanks, Doug.
All right. Thanks again.